Hello, everyone, and welcome to Linux for the Rest of Us, episode 193. This is a show about all things Linux, whether it's hardware, software, whatever tickles our Linux fancy. I am Cody Cooper, a.k.a. Supercoop, and I am here once again with my good friend, the Linux maven, Stephen McLaughlin. How's it going, Dor?
Mr. Cooper, it actually has only been a week. Feels like it's been a month. The new podnuts.com domain is up and running. It's still going through iterations. It's still getting updated. It's still getting fixed. It's still getting finalized. There's definitely still more things that need to be done. But I am really happy about the progress that's been made so far. And I really encourage people, stop by podnuts.com. Shoot me an email on your thoughts on the website. Is there stuff missing? I know there's stuff missing, but I also know there's stuff that's missing that I don't know that's missing.
And if you're having an issue with any of your podcatchers and or other podcast audio devices or software, please send an email to dor@podnuts.com and let them know. We actually had an issue with an iTunes listener. Emailed us, what, today or yesterday, Dor, letting us know what was going on with the native Apple Podcasts app. And before you hate, remember, that's how years ago I stumbled upon the network. So that's allowed, whoever that was. So,
well, I look at it as maybe his significant other or parent, whatever, got him the device. And that's his excuse for still having it. And that's what, in my mind, I stick with.
Yeah, okay. But then again, you tell yourself a lot of lies, Dor. So I do. And at the end of the day, that's just not healthy.
It's not, but it works.
And if I'm not mistaken, we do have a guest. Who do we have on the show, Dor? Who was with us today?
We have a guy I've met, I think, at two conferences now. I wish I would have met him at still more, but I was never able to make it out to Indiana Linux Fest. We have Lord, I'm going to try to say this right, Lord Drakenblut, Matthew Williams, talking to us about his Indiegogo campaign with extremely righteous and progressive plans ahead of him.
Well, thank you, Dor. Pleasure to be on the show with you and Cody tonight. And that project would be Open FOSS Training. And the big goal of it is to create videos and documentation that are easy to follow for the new user.
That's a really nice way to put it. What I would add in there is extremely gracious in the realm of topics. Extremely gracious in the distribution that he's talking about whenever he talks about a Linux topic. But the most poignant, the two most poignant facts are, with whatever the users want is going to be driving the demand for the people who do contribute to the Indiegogo campaign. But the biggest and most important thing is he's not doing craptastic videos with people screaming in the background and taking 15 minutes to describe a 3-minute thing like you see on YouTube. He's doing utterly professional grade videos that, honestly, I haven't, when I go to training things, their videos suck. His videos that I've seen have been blowing away what I consider normal training quality videos. So I gotta say, obsessively good quality videos.
Yeah, thank you. I just, you know, as you said, put out the first video in the series for things. And some people might be scratching their heads considering where I decided to start things. But I think it's a safe place for a lot of people to start. And that is, I started with showing people how to install VirtualBox on a Windows 10 machine. There we'll go on to how to install Linux distributions inside of VirtualBox. And then after that, and we show people how to do some of the basics from there, then we'll move on to showing people how to actually install bare metal.
Yeah, when it comes to, I mean, I did watch the video just today, and I'm going to say, yes, very, very high quality production value. What I do want to say, though, is that, yeah, that's the perfect place to start, because when you're trying to get people to dip their toe in, you have either, you know, a VirtualBox install or live CD. But with a lot of people not keeping physical media around or physical writable media around anymore, obviously the USB alternative, but even writing an image to a USB can be a hurdle, a small speed bump that some people hit that they, I don't even want to try this. But installing VirtualBox and then doing it very, very simply, step by step, even though there aren't that many steps, realistically, is a fantastic way to go about it and definitely a good place to start.
And all the videos that we produce, we're aiming for no. So if that means we have to break a section up, we will, and we'll try to find a very logical place to break them.
Very good. Very good.
Very cool. And I'll say, part of the reason you're hearing Matthew in the quality that you're hearing Matthew is he is extremely bandwidth limited, which is why what he's doing, to be honest, makes even more sense. He wants to contribute. He wants to give back. He wants to help. He wants to assist. So what he's doing is he's doing these videos in his house, on his local computer, putting them up to a professional grade, and then uploading them when his bandwidth allows. To me, this is a perfect example of doing what you can to help, period. And this is one way that he figured it out. But I got to ask you, Matthew, what was the thing that got you started thinking about doing this? Because to me, this is a pretty bold endeavor you're going on.
Well, I'd say it kind of came from two things. One is my own very early days of Linux and running face first into the RTFM brigade. When, you know, people are saying, read the frickin' manual, and I'm going, well, your frickin' manual isn't all that helpful for new people. And initially, I kind of walked away and came back about 2 years later when I ran into a group of people who were much more willing to help someone who would say, yeah, the manual's not that great. Here's the information you're looking for. And recently, a friend of mine asked me to set up a laptop he had recently acquired to be in a kind of a dual boot situation running Windows and Corora on his machine. And I kind of wanted a way to be able to show him after the initial install how to do things on his system. And got to thinking about, well, why do this stuff, you know, individually piecemeal to show people when I can make these videos to help people, you know, help a broader audience out.
Yeah, and I will say, to me, the other reason to do this is the manual is one thing. The manual is out there. The manual, though, is a very, even if it's constantly upgraded, it's a very static set of text. Some people have a very hard time mowing through text documents and pulling comprehension out of it. I am one of those people. When I see someone do something on video showing me examples, I'm seeing clicks happen kind of thing, it, to me, makes a whole nother level of comprehension happen. So for people like me out there who like to learn visually, this to me is really the only way to do it. Just my experience.
And with video, a lot of times you might see a step that someone forgets to put in written documentation that is just so obvious to them when they're writing the documentation they leave out, but for someone new to the experience, very important.
And also just having, I mean, and also being able to cater to different types of learning styles. I mean, when you're talking about learning a different operating system or let alone installing it for the first time, some people need a little more hand-holding, would like to have someone there, or do others do really well text-based, you know, step-by-step, but video, and also producing the video, you know, you're not missing steps because you're actually doing it, but also providing it in a medium that a lot of people might take to better. For instance, if I wrote a 2-paragraph paper on, let's just say, bacon, if I wrote a 2-paragraph article on bacon, Door wouldn't read it because it's too much text for Door. And I don't respect that. I understand it, but being able to cater to different audiences and provide them with different mediums for your content is a good job.
What did you say my name? Sorry, I missed that.
Yeah, whatever.
Well, and here to me is the double whammy of goodness. He's doing these videos. He's an educated Linux user. I have no qualms with saying this in front of the world. I think it's pretty safe to say Matthew knows more about the inner workings of Linux than I know. I also don't have any qualms with saying 99, a huge percentage, virtually everything I learned about OBS and how to use it and how to function it and how to tweak it and how to set it and how to how to chroma key it was from him. He was digging into it. He was pounding on it. He was playing with it, toying with it, and then saying, hey, Dora, try this. Hey, Dora, try this. Hey, you know, try this. It's only because of him and his knowledge I'm able to do what I'm able to do on these podcasts. So that's why I support him. I support those who support me, kind of thing. Matthew has supported me
and
much more than he has ever had to.
And I'm sitting there and I'm watching change logs between versions, you know, 0.12, 0.12.1, you know, I'm watching to see what's coming up. I can tell you, you know, I'd have to double check again, but some features that me and you are, you know, waiting on are coming in 0.13 or 0.14, such as media playback control.
Awesome.
So speaking about producing this in OBS, let me ask you this. From someone who, and I know very little of it. I don't do any of that production. I don't do any of that the production on that side of the show. So I have a very, very limited experience with the interface. But from a layman's or a newbie standpoint, how hard did you think it would be to produce content of this quality with this software? And how hard was it actually?
I didn't think it'd be that hard actually, since I kind of waited for it to get to the point it's at. There were a couple little stumbling blocks that I kind of hit along the way that I went, oh, well, here's a workaround that'll work until they get this certain feature going. But past that, you know, it's just having the hardware at your availability and the patience to take the time to kind of test things and make sure they're going to work the way you expect them to.
So what you're saying is that you were very responsible when going about it.
I tried to be.
And there you go. Good deal. Good deal.
Very cool. Very cool. Now and here's another thing of positivity on top of this. He's doing videos in a very professional manner. He is pretty highly educated on Linux. He's devoted more years and more time during the year to learn the inner workings of Linux. He is presenting these in a very, I'll put this, rational, logical way, and he's using very logical speak in them as well. He is not talking over people's head. But when you're done each video, can I ask what happens to the video? Does it go behind the paywall? Does it go into a vault? Do you burn it on a laser disc and send it out to people by mail or what?
What I do with the video is I first upload it to an unlisted site for the other members of the team and a few people outside the team to review it. And then I push it publicly on YouTube under a Creative Commons license. To follow, it will be going up on archive.org soon. I'm going to be investigating other sites that I can upload it to. So these are going to be under a Creative Commons attribution license, and people can use them how they want.
Yeah, that to me is like unbelievably cool and open of you, I'll say. And now here's a curveball kind of question. When you're done the Indiegogo, when you start to get into full production swing, are you going to try any other, I'll say, internet mechanisms in order to get support?
I don't know at this time. That's all to be considered. I am actually in a very awkward position financially, where because of my health issues, because of the, you know, cancer I'm dealing with, I'm actually on Medicaid disability and Social Security disability incomes. So if I make too much money, I risk losing both of those.
Oh, okay.
I didn't even think of that. And the main reason I was saying that was because I know you have a thirst to have really good hardware to do these videos on. And I know when I say really good hardware, I don't think the people at home, I'll say, quote unquote, really understand the level of hardware you're looking at getting, because among other things, you're looking at doing the beginning, basic video, but also emulating at one point in time entire domains showing the inner workings of how you can do things over a network.
Yeah, definitely. I would like to be able to, in time, be able to show people, you know, through virtualization at least, how to set up something like pfSense to be their home router and how they could create a NAS box to, in their home setting and how to be able to tie that to their own machines. And when you start, you know, running 3-4 virtual machines and trying to record them all at the same time, you know, you definitely require some heavy resources. And for doing the, when I get to the point of wanting to show people how to install on hardware, there is a particular video capture device I'm interested in getting, and that device alone is $300.
Yeah, that capture equipment can get pretty expensive. Let me ask, though, what is the device, though? I'm interested to see, because I'm personally looking to do some capturing, and I haven't really researched on what I could use within Linux, but what is the device you're looking at?
The device I'm looking at is put out by a company called Magewell, and I don't have the exact model number memorized, but they make a device that has HDMI input on one side and USB 3 output on the other. And you just, and it's just plug and play. It works under Linux, Windows, and OS X with no drivers required. Under Linux, it shows up as a video for Linux device, just like a webcam does.
Yeah, I'm going to say right now, I do believe this is the exact device I asked a couple guys I know that do some capture for recommendations on devices, and I do think that this one was it. I want to say it was the Magewell X100 XUSB Pro, I think was the one that they were saying, where you basically need no software. And that kind of blew me away, because I'm like, on Linux? They said, yeah, no software needed. Because when I started thinking about video capturing, I kept thinking software tumors would emerge, you know, kind of thing. It'd be painfully, painfully hard to get everything working. So that sounds really good, actually.
Yeah, from all the reviews I've seen of it across YouTube, it is an excellent device, works very well.
Yeah, I'm looking at the site right now. This is, yeah, I had no idea. Because when you think of, you know, capture devices, you think of, I mean, personally, I would think of like Elgato, Hapag.
Or Blackmagic.
Right. Yeah. The heavy hitters that when you're talking about, you know, that really cater as far as like all-in-one solution boxes, external units versus just capture cards. They're usually going toward the gamer, like Twitch market, or maybe YouTube gaming a little bit, but mainly Twitch people. So, I had never even heard of this company. So it, very, very, very neat.
Yeah, I think they are definitely a under-recognized player in the market.
Yeah, right there also, full-on, right there under features, compatible with Windows, compatible with Linux, compatible with OS X, plug-and-play, does USB 3.0 out, which is good, much better throughput there.
Yep, the only thing you need to do in some cases is put an HDMI splitter before that device.
Right, yeah, I get that. I've dealt with something like this before, and it required the same thing. And you can get decent ones of those on partners.com/Amazon, malicious plug, for like less than $40.
Yeah, real quick question, Lordy. If people are in, first off, let's say they're interested to learn more about that, about your open false training. I'm showing pages on Indiegogo, Reddit, Facebook. And I also see a YouTube channel, and I also just see openfalsetraining.com. Do you have a preference where you think people should go?
I think people should start at the openfalsetraining.com website. Most of the links to everywhere are on the openfalsetraining.com website. We need to add the Reddit subreddit to the page, but that will get you almost everywhere. The Indiegogo campaign you can find at igg.me/at/openfalsetraining. And I definitely want to make sure to thank someone you like to bring up a lot, that they're helping to back the Open False Training's Indiegogo campaign, and that's Think Penguin.
Very cool, very cool. Yeah.
Most definitely supporting the community.
Right. To be honest, I thought you were going to say Clot too, because he's supporting too. And to me, that's one of the watermarks. That's one of, like, the yardsticks, okay? Anything Klaatu supports, by default, people should like, and if they don't like, there's probably something wrong with them, number one. For Think Penguin to support something, that means it has nothing but the end user as the priority. And I can say everything I've seen you do in the realm of Linux, whether it be conferences, whether it be events, whether it be how you interact with podcasts, not just my podcast, many other podcasts, or how you're doing this video training, it does seem like you always have the user's best interest at heart.
I definitely try to. And, you know, since you brought up Klaatu, I will say, and I've talked with him and cleared this first because he did these as two anonymous donations initially, but he has donated at the $250 level. So when the Indiegogo campaign is complete, and we start producing videos after, you know, the videos we produce after that point, some of them will carry that they've been sponsored by slackermedia.info, another great site for Linux knowledge, specifically how to produce multimedia under Linux.
Very good. I would also recommend, you know, anybody who hasn't already, but if you're listening to this and maybe at home, definitely check out the videos because you can get a taste of the intent and definitely the quality. And I wish you the best of luck with the campaign, and I can't wait to see what kind of content you guys put out in the near future.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'll say all the links to everything will be in the show notes. I don't propagate a lot of things, I will say that. But when this Indiegogo is drawing to an end, I am going to, on the Podnuts Twitter, post about it. I am going to post about it on Google Plus and on every place I can. I will try to time a mentioning of it in the podcast to a, so people will have a chance to come in last second kind of thing. But I also want to publicize when you put out other videos. Because to me, when the Indiegogo thing comes to an end, it is literally like birth has been given, and now this is where the fun actually begins. Can I ask, how much longer do we have to go on the Indiegogo?
Something like 40 days. I don't have the site in front of me to see how long it has left.
Yeah, looks like 40 days exactly, which I'm going to say is going to end about November 18th or so?
23rd.
I was close.
So even though there's plenty of time, head over there soon, sooner rather than later. If you like what he's doing, if you like the content, contribute what you can, because it's this kind of content that we need out there in order to be provided for people, in order to not spark interest, but to nurture interest in this platform that we all love, in order to give them the best start possible. Because when Matthew was talking about his start in Linux, obviously, and as many people have experienced, you know, the RTFM, you know, type of attitude, I only encountered a small taste of that back in 2008, 2007, when I first started. But since then, I've experienced a nice open community, a lot of people that I can reach out to, a lot of great web content. And I can say that some of the out of all the content I have seen, this is well produced. So definitely, definitely give it the time of day. And if you do feel that there is value for it in yourself or for someone that you would like to give it to, or anybody that you do know, please contribute if you can.
Absolutely. Matthew, are there any things you want to make sure that the people hear before we end?
Just we appreciate all the support people can give us, whether spread the word, you know, it all adds up and helps out. Again, I'd like to, you know, thank Think Penguin for helping to back the campaign. Anyone who donates $25 or above will get stuffed Tux Penguin from Think Penguin. $100 and above will be receiving a Tux Penguin and a $50 coupon for Think Penguin's website.
Very nice. I did not know that. And if you don't love stuffed penguins, there's something wrong with you. So definitely get on that ball. I know I'm going
to. Absolutely, absolutely. Matthew, I definitely want to thank you for coming out, and please do not hesitate to let us know about updates that you would like to be announced on the show.
I will definitely keep you guys posted.
Awesome, awesome. I thank you very much.
Thank you.
Take care, Matthew. Thanks again.
Take it easy, Cody.
Okay, let's get into some links here, Cody. I do not have a lot of links this show.
Dor, what have I said to you for the past 4 or 5 years? It's not about quantity, it's about quality.
I don't know what you're talking about. I think this is quality. I will say that. Okay, the first link I want to put out there is by a guy by the name of Great Scott. It's a YouTube video. And a lot of people hear about the Raspberry Pi, I'm going to say, is going to be my number one example. But I will say is there is a large selection of other devices out there. Here's a video on Great Scott on YouTube. It was published maybe a couple weeks ago. And it's basically, he's talking about what he calls the big three hitters in single board computing. Raspberry Pi, Banana Pi, and Orange Pi. Okay. The main reason he calls these three the big heavy hitters is either A, they are popular, or B, they are affordable and powerful. Okay. And he is ridiculously fair in this video. I'm going to say that uncommonly fair. In he basically lines all three of these boards up and he rates them based upon hardware specs, software specs, and support. And I'm going to say, in my opinion, if you know what you're going to do and it's a server-based task you're going to do, you almost have to go Banana Pi. If you want a device where you just want to have fun and try a billion different things, it has to be the Raspberry Pi. If you have very small needs and you really don't have a lot of money, you have to go the Orange Pi. The Orange Pi is only $30, and it is really powerful for the $30. The downside to the Orange Pi is you don't have as much software to pick from. You don't have as much support to look for. And for like custom cases for it, you're going to have much less options for it. If you're looking for project, if you're searching the internet for projects, you're going to find much less with the Orange Pi. But he goes over all three of these very finely, I'm going to say, in a very exact measurement kind of thing. And it's only a 7-minute video. But this guy does great videos, is what I'm going to say. He breaks down these SMB computers to the nth degree, and he really goes into detail explaining his experiences on all of them. And apparently he has a lot of time to play with these things.
I haven't had a chance to look at the video yet, but what I will say is that you're right when you start doing the breakdown. Obviously, the Raspberry Pi, the more supported format out there as far as SBCs, it's a fantastic unit. But more importantly, when you're talking about a server application or server-side application, the reason, and I know two of the main reasons, but will you please reiterate and tell the audience why the Banana Pro or the Banana Pi might be the better option?
It's because for raw hardware for server-type specs, it blows everything out of the water. It has a true gigabit right. Ethernet port. None of the other ones
yes.
do. Mm-hmm. It has a eSATA port. I mean, sorry, a SATA port on it.
Yep.
None of the other ones do.
Yes.
Its mm-hmm. graphics processor isn't tremendous, but its processor and RAM is really good. So if you need taxing things done to it, you can't beat the Banana Pi. I mean, I have my Banana Pi now running my own cloud server almost consistently now for 5 months, I'm going to say, 5 or 6 months. And I yesterday, like 2 days ago, finally actually started experiencing an issue with it. I wasn't sure what the issue was, but then I came down, I started doing things, and I could hear the hard drive making one of those sounds. The hell was that?
Oh, jeez.
I rebooted it.
That's the worst. Whoa.
I heard it, I rebooted it, and I started doing another sync, and I heard, man, this ain't good. Yeah, so I panicked. I'm thinking the hard drive is dying. So all I did was unmount the drive in Linux. I remoted into the desktop. I unmounted the drive. I ran gparted. I unmounted the drive. And then I just right-clicked on the partition and said check, which I thought was going to do like a disk check, a file check, like a Windows, you know, check disk kind of thing. But of course, not the Windows kind, the Linux kind. And I thought it would literally take, because it's a 500 gig drive, I thought it would take 20 minutes or something, 10 minutes at least. It took 3 seconds.
That's
no,
fair.
So I thought it did nothing.
Okay.
Well, that was a waste of time. Let me just mount the drive again. And then I start, and then now for 2 days, I haven't had any issues with it. So I have no idea what that check did. And everybody I talked to also says they're not sure what it could have done, but now I have no problems with it again. But I did go and buy a replacement hard drive for it. I'll be getting it in here soon. I'm going to replace it. But the throughput I'm getting on it is phenomenal. The uptime I'm getting on it is phenomenal. Everybody who's syncing to this, because it ain't just me, people, I'm using noip.com.
That's right.
I have Martin Obando, Mitch Heyman, Eric Ardini, Mark Cockrell, and at least one or two other people using it as basically their remote storage. And no one's complaining about speed at all. In fact, they're saying how fast it is. And here on my local LAN, it's like snappy, where I know if I did this with a Raspberry Pi and a USB hard drive, it'll be slow as molasses.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. The two main applications I was talking about, or not applications, the two main features, I should say, were those two, the onboard gigabit Ethernet and the full-on just SATA port. Because, yeah, having to bus it through USB, you're going to run it. I mean, especially when you're talking about performance on a little machine like that, yeah, you don't want to have... If you can have it right there on the board, especially, you know, data transfer and overall internet connection speed, it's a no-brainer. And also, the nice thing about this, too, is that we're not talking about a $300 option versus a $500 option versus a $700 option. The Orange Pi is $30. Raspberry Pi, what, $35 to $40 right now, yeah. About, right? And then the Banana Pro is less than $60, right?
Yeah, if you look around even a little bit, you'll find it for $50.
Yeah, and I'm just talking bare board, because of course once everybody starts going, oh, I'll buy the kit with the SD card and the case and, you know, the risers and the extra the external fan, all yada yada, yeah, just bare board. So when we say affordable, they're affordable, and between the three of them, depending on, well, I shouldn't say depending, but between the three of them, if you have a need or just a want to get one of these, they're going to be within your price range. Maybe not immediately, but, you know, skip a few coffees, don't buy lunch next week, you'll get it.
Yeah, that's to me the beautiful part. It is lowered the entry fee, if you will, to playing with a server or having a headless computer in your area to do anything, whether it be automated things with home automation, or whether it be having your own server to do backups or for VPN purposes. It just makes it really, really accessible.
Not only lowering the entry, but also lowering the long-term costs of maintenance and upkeep, not to mention virtually soundless. I mean, you're talking very, very little sound coming off of the device versus, you know, any sort of a real, you know, server like Chuck Litchfield, a listener of ours. I can't remember if he listens to this show anymore. Probably.
I hope.
Shout out to Chuck. Anyway, I know he's a big Android App Addicts fan. I can't remember talking to him about this show recently. Anyway, Chuck is a fellow Oregonian, but he gave me, or excuse me, I know someone, wink, that got me some equipment that wasn't being used by their employer anymore and was told to destroy. So I acquired a server, and I remember turning it on for the first time, having only been around a rack of servers at one point and thinking, whoa, that's loud. And wow, that takes a lot of power versus what am I going to use it for? I could probably just do that on this Raspberry Pi I have sitting here.
Yeah, that's a thing.
So I did that instead.
Mine's making zero noise, and it's going to come down to this. If you really can't afford anything, get the Orange Pi. It's $30. If you need to do like a XBMC front end or a MythTV front end, connecting it to a computer, catching a stream and displaying it on your TV, you're probably better to do it with the Raspberry Pi. The video shows if you want to do 4K video, I said 4K video, you got to get the Orange Pi.
How many Ks?
Video.
Oh, okay.
Got which it. I'm sure equates to like 60 FERPs or something. I don't know. Just to quote Vin Stone. But if you want to do server type things, web server, database server, then you got to go banana. You know, that to me is the distinguishing difference between the three.
I have to interrupt you for just a second because I know that Pedro also listens to this show. FERPS is frames per second. 4K is the resolution. Right.
But did you know this?
Okay. I'm just saying. Lay it on me, brother.
The original Game Boy, not the Game Boy Color, not the Game Boy Advance, not the Game Boy DS or anything, but the original monochrome Game Boy played at 60 frames per second.
Yeah. Do you know why?
Probably because it had to make up for the blur that happened.
That's part of it, but it also has to do with the demands of the original creator of that device. They went no color on purpose because they wanted smoother gameplay, therefore a higher frame rate for FPS. And they continued to outsell their their colored competitors, forgive me.
Wow, you're amazing.
For years before they had to feel compelled enough to release a color a device that played color. They didn't need it. And he swore up and down. He goes, "We don't need it. We just need it to look good." So yes, I totally believe that. And I still have one to this day. Somewhere in my garage, I get nostalgic. I put in Tetris. I'm like, oh, this is so great. And I think, I hate this music because it reminds me of playing Tetris as a kid because I do it for hours. And then I put it back in its box and I'll see you in five years.
To me, that was the big thing. The other game consoles didn't stand a chance. A, the Game Boy was cheap. B, it had Tetris. Hard.
That's right. Did you ever have a Game Gear?
Hell no, Gear? Didn't have no Game Gear.
Did you have a Sega Nomad?
Never heard of a Sega Nomad.
Sega Nomad was a portable Genesis. They between the Nomad and the Game Gear, they sucked battery life. Oh my lord! Yeah, which is another thing. Batteries. I mean, you talk about four AA's for the original Game Boy, and it still lasted a long time.
I mean, I never owned one. I did rent one from my local video game store for a couple days, and I literally pounded through Super Mario Land. I want to say. I just crushed that damn
Super what?
Super Mario Land.
Super what?
I believe that's what it was called, if I'm not mistaken.
I thought it was Super Mario Land, because that's how he says his own
name. When I was playing it, he didn't talk, okay? It's the truth.
You don't have to get all defensive about it. I love bacon, too. Player. I'm not mad. I'm just telling. I'm not arguing with you. I'm just telling you that you're wrong.
Because I played the game. But I literally crushed that game in literally less than 3 hours after powering it on. And I remember thinking the batteries were actually decent on this thing. And then 2 days later, I returned it and I never thought about it again.
Do you see what happens, folks, ladies and gentlemen, when we don't talk about gaming for, 2-3 weeks? We just have to let it out. We're bursting at the seams and we've delved into a rabbit hole to the point where I even forgot the original topic. I had to look at the notes and then, that's what we were talking about, 4K video on a Raspberry Pi. But I believe we're sufficiently done with that link, correct?
Yes, but I'm going to take us down a rabbit hole just to touch again.
Here we go, children.
You want to go talk about retro gaming? Let me get off of the mobile site and get on the full website to this thing. I bought this device 2 weeks ago. It's called a GPD XD 5-inch Android 4.4 gamepad, 2 GB. RAM, 32 gigabyte internal storage, RK3288 quad core, 1.8 gigahertz handheld game console, H-IPS 1280 by 720 HDMI game tablet PC black. Oh my lord. So catchy. It just rolls off the tongue. Okay. What it is it's a ripped off hardware form factor of a 3DS XL.
The new Nintendo 3DS XL.
It has no screen on the bottom, a much wider touch screen on the top, higher resolution screen than at least I see on my son's 3DS. No 3D, of course. The top is a touch screen. The bottom, you have two left and right shoulder buttons. You have dual joysticks. You have four buttons, directional pad. Then you have L3 and R3 buttons as well. This thing runs Android classic consoles like a champ. I mean, I'm even running like Grand Theft Auto 2, PS1, beautifully. I'm running Nintendo 64, Zelda, Mario, just golden, exquisitely. And I'm running more advanced, harder games, graphical Android games. It's just running like a champ. And right now it's $149. When I got it, it was $160. But last week it was on sale for $109.
And also keep in mind that Dore is emulating these games legally from backups that he made on purpose, because you guys have heard all the stories about the violence in Baltimore. What you might not know is that there are actually ninjas who go around the city in which he lives, which I won't name because I don't want everybody banging on Dore's door. He'll yell at you, tell you to get off his lawn, because that's his pastime, it's his hobby. But ninjas break into people's houses and they steal their classic video game collections all the time. And we need to make backups by law to have these just in case, because we own the physical copies. We're perfectly within our legal rights to do that. Exactly.
And I will say one thing.
Sorry, because ninjas.
And nasty ninjas, too. They don't like a lot of people.
That's right.
One thing that this device has over other devices, two things. It charges with normal micro USB. It also has a 3,000 milliamp battery where I'm getting at least 5 hours gameplay out of it. So I would encourage people, if you really love your retro gaming and you have legal copies of all your games all ready to roll, or you really like the idea of Android gaming with a device you can put in your pocket and you don't have to worry about getting phone calls on, this thing is really, really good. And I got it over at Geek Buying. You can get it on Amazon. And normal shows and sites and networks would tell you, you need to go over to Amazon and get it and use podnos.com/Amazon. But on Amazon, which you can do. But it's literally like $20 more.
You can totally do that. But maybe you shouldn't if you want to save money. I encourage
people, save money. Yeah. When you buy toilet paper or diapers for your kid or something, then go to podnos.com/Amazon. But when you're trying to save money, don't worry about it.
Very good. But hey, so I'm pulling us out of the rabbit hole. Whoa. Okay, we're back on track. This next link, I saw this today, and I did that little, like, the miniature clap. Like, my hands are really close together, almost the giddy clap, you could call it. I was like, oh, thank God, because I was getting ready to purchase and or set up one of these for my father. But now we have this. So go ahead and tell us all about it, Dore. You back? Cool. All right. I will make a timestamp really quick. Cool. All right. So what I was saying is I'm glad that we had this link in the show notes, because I saw this earlier. Kane St. Rose posted this. A link to this awesome project. Cloud Ready. So Dore, lay it on me. How does this thing work? Oh, and plus, this is one of our favorite websites as far as like geeky articles. But I love the way you say it. So what's the website this article is from?
It's Lil Putin, ain't it? It's Lil Putin. Lil Putin, whatever. LilPutin.com. Okay, yeah. Kana is the man, I'll say first off. Stop laughing. And he was one of the first people I saw to give the link. I haven't had time to play with this, okay? It sales pitches turn any computer into a Chromebook. Okay, now here's the thing. People in the know want to scream right now and say, what are you talking about? All you got to do is follow HEXXEH and install Cherry Boot or whatever it is, and there's your Chromebook. Yes and no. Okay. There's been non-official Chrome OS type things in the past, but they're not Chrome OS. Okay. A, they don't update. B, they don't have Pepper Flash support in them or Java, anything. It's just the browser itself. C, you had extremely shaky hardware support. You never knew what was going to work or what wasn't going to work. And then lastly, you didn't know if you would even be able to install it. Okay. It was not rock solid. It was more of a playing around kind of thing. These people over at Neverware, A, have an insanely polished website. Including the ability to chat with someone in their New York City office right now, button at the bottom, where they have three links off their main page for educators, for individuals, and for enterprises. Okay. If you download the for individuals version, it is quote unquote completely free. It does have Flash and it does have support for Iced-T, which is another Java like thing. And it says it does update, and they say they have a very broad range of hardware support. So this might be that mystical golden unicorn with golden sheep fur or something, where you can literally turn any computer into a Chrome OS-like experience. For old hardware or for people with limited needs, this really could be fantastic.
And my dad has limited needs. He needs to do a few things. And he was contemplating buying a new Mac. And I said, you're out of your mind. Not because that Macs are bad. Hardware is hardware. But with the model he wanted to get, for a fraction of that, he could get something that would suit his needs. So it's not that I was trying to talk him out of buying Apple hardware per se. I was simply just trying to help him, you know, I was assessing his needs and then making a recommendation. And then I saw this today and I was like, there you go.
Yeah, this really should be a very easy process. And I will say one of the things I really like that if you download the info link, it's a full page brochure style PDF, basically helping you guide you through the process of how to download, how to install, how to do everything you want on it. Really handy, really nice is what I'm going to say. These people are trying to be professional. I really want to try this. Kana did say he was going to try it tonight and post his results back in Google Plus. I'm going to guess he got pretty good results.
Well, I'll definitely try it out. I have, I've got too many damn machines around here, but I've definitely something I could throw it on and then give it to him to play with for a little bit. And I mean, I'll try it.
Yeah, it could be very cool. I just got to figure out what device I want to put mine on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I got a older Dell laptop laying right here. Oh, you know what? Screw that. I'm putting this on. I have a daily driver laptop I take to work with me. It's this 15-inch Toshiba. It's a Fisher-Price laptop, basically what it is. I didn't pay for it, and it suits my needs for what I need at work, so I take it. But, man, I would rather have something snappy with this. Although, I gotta say, I didn't see some on the notes here. I gotta throw this in. And I'm not trying to hate. I'm not trying to cause panic. But I have a document that I reference every week on Google Docs. To do a very particular task. And Friday or Saturday, I had to access this document for said task, and Google Docs was down.
Yeah, completely down for full day, I want to say, or 2 days.
Yeah, and when I think about my user case, I was just like, no big deal. I wish I had access to it. I don't need it. It's not a job requirement. You know, I'm not losing money because of this. I'm not losing any sleep. I'm not freaking out. It isn't for school. I don't have a paper to turn in, an assignment, you know, an article to write, nothing like that. But then I started thinking, what about those people that do have all those problems now because this is down? And also, we don't know when it's coming back up. So that really made me evaluate what I'm doing, these services that I'm using. I'm not saying don't use cloud services, but if you are in need of such a document, or something of that nature that you need to reference a lot, back it up in the cloud or have it be able to work on something locally and have it sync to the cloud. There's plenty of ways to do that. But I'm very, very wary about just relying on certain things for Google Docs or for any cloud-based service. So I'm going to alter my mindset to prevent that from prevent that from hindering my workflow in the future.
Yeah, and I will say this is, okay, I'm not going to talk all bad about it, but here's one plus. If you have a Chromebook, one of the things it wants to install by default is Google Docs offline mode. So those people with Chromebooks might not have even realized that they were down when they were doing stuff unless they went and tried to share something or access something on a different computer. That is one of the things where even on your desktop, if you're running Chrome browser, you can have that plugin enabled to do offline Google Docs. So you could have done that. I will say, to me, that's just another reason to have own cloud. Everything's going to go down. Here's my logic. Everything's going to go down. Would you rather, shake your fist at something you can't see called Google, or would you rather shake your fist at something right in front of you that isn't working? Me personally, I like having something right in front of me because then I know I might be able to fix it instead of just refresh, 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 and just waiting for somebody else to fix the issue.
I'm patient. I don't mind. It just, like I said, luckily it wasn't the situation. And I'm not saying that as a deterrent from using this. Yes, I have used offline mode on the two Chromebooks I've owned, and it's fantastic. But I don't have those machines anymore, so I couldn't even look at the document that way. And I was more disappointed than upset.
Gotcha.
Okay, so. Yeah,
I did want to bring this link up, and it's really only for one reason. People should notice a trend. In the last couple episodes, we've been talking about other companies who specialize in closed-sourced whatever, utilizing, using, taking advantage of, or in some cases, creating their own based off of the GPL software system of open source. Okay, here's another example of it. Apple is secretive about what kind of toilet paper they buy, I'm sure. They don't want anyone to know anything about them unless they want you to know about them. Then they flaunt about them. Here's one of the times where it looks like Apple has reportedly dumped VMware in a move that could save its millions of dollars, but what it is moving to is a free and open solution of KVM. KVM is the near bare metal virtualization layer that really does get you a lot of bang for your buck. Now, what they lose by going away from closed sources, not the ability to virtualize, but all the little tools that come with it. Something tells me, I mean, Apple still runs their website off HTML, static HTML pages. Something tells me their inner workings are not extremely complex, to where all they need is just virtual machines spun up in their office. They don't need heavy, heavy additions and manipulations of those OSs. But the advantage they get is they're saving tons of money by going with KVM. So this is this looks like another example of a major institution dropping proprietary code for open solutions, even though its primary mechanism for making money is creating proprietary code to run on their computers. So again, more people using open solutions, to be honest, is better for a lot of us, and now it's even better for Apple.
And I would implore them to take that millions of, is it millions?
Yeah.
Wasn't it like, oh yeah, $20 million in savings for the next 2 years and pass at least a little bit of that savings onto their customers, please? Man, them watches are expensive, Dor. Have you seen the prices on them watches?
Yeah, well, I'm going to channel Tim Cook, I believe his name is. Good, Goody, hold your breath. And we'll let you know when to start breathing again. Because they're going to constantly lay the screws to everybody. This is something I just wanted to talk about really quick, because your friend and mine, and when I say that, he really is your friend and mine, Martin Rambo Bando, has got me using a fat email client again, after I thought I never would. I mean, it's been 6 years since I've used the email client.
Wait a minute. Wait a GD minute here. You're using like when I was a kid, I would have to install a program on my computer in order to download emails to the program and then like save them in folders and stuff. That's what you're doing now?
Yes, Cody, just like you do on your Android device. Except I'm doing it on a computer.
Shut your mouth. Now, is this in some sort of like a nostalgic nod to the actual anniversary date of October 21st for Back to the Future?
Absolutely not. Two?
Like we're in 2015.
No, because I'm not that smart. But that would be cool.
Is this computer installed inside of a DeLorean?
I wish I had a DeLorean now. No.
No, you don't. Upkeep is way too expensive. Yeah. Talk about expensive. That makes the monetary upkeep on DeLorean makes Apple Watches look cheap. That is expensive stuff.
It really was spurred on because I wanted to prepare for the possibility of not using any Google email services anymore. So I said, if I'm using a non-Gmail app on my phone and I'm using a fat client on my desktop computer, hypothetically, it would be easier to transition away from Gmail. So I'm using Thunderbird Martin pointed me towards more than a couple plugins that really help the Thunderbird interface and connecting to backend services to synchronize stuff like contacts and calendars. But this one caught my eye over at omgubuntu.co.uk, a site I have not mentioned in a long time, it seems like. This email application is called N1. N is in Nancy and the number one. I don't know how to describe this except for it looks like a email application I would see running on a tablet, which I really don't mean to be as an insult, but it kind of comes off sounding like an insult. It's new right now. It's by invite only. You can send them a request to download it, install it. It might be, quote unquote, I will say, fun. I did put my request and haven't heard anything back. I do like the idea now of being able to write email, quote unquote, offline. Don't need a browser to connect. Because I don't know if you've noticed it, Cody. I don't care what the browser is. I don't care what your processor is. I don't care what your RAM is. I don't care what your operating system is. You go to gmail.com, and sometimes it takes more than 10 seconds for that page to completely load.
True story, man. True story. I was using some ancient piece of hardware lately, and I tried booting up Gmail, and it took forever. I just did it as a joke. I can't even remember what it was now. Oh, it was something at my local Goodwill that I asked to plug in and test. What the hell was it? I don't know. Anyway, yes, I understand. Because, yes, that's very true. And when you talk about outages, or if you just, dude, I'm all for trying to compartmentalize some of my workflow. So nowadays when I'm answering emails or if I want to write emails that I know that don't need to be done immediately, I would rather sit down for X amount of time, whether it's 15, 30, 60 minutes or longer, if I'm backlogged, and just bang it out and get it done. And if I can do that while at the park, I'm sorry, I haven't been to the park forever. But untethered from society, if I can just do that with a program like this, aside from just writing it in a doc and copying and pasting it later, that's neat. That's cool. Although I'm almost never at a destination where I don't have an internet connection. That being said, there is a market for that.
And here's the scary part. I think the whole reason I went to a web interface initially was because I don't know if it was real or not, but it seemed quicker because I'm already in a browser to just load another tab. That's the thing. It's quicker.
Are you talking about when you first started using
Gmail? Or any kind of webmail. It was practically quicker to just open up a new tab and go to whatever the email web portal was and load that. It's now obsessively quicker for me to double click on Thunderbird than load any web interface for email. And I will say it's almost that Chrome OS type experience of when I open this, when I click this icon very deliberately, I'm now in email mode. There's no ads. There's no other tabs. There's no nothing else I can do. I'm doing email. So that's kind of a plus for me.
Yes. And also the benefit of that too is that if you set something like this up in order to accomplish that task, there was a program I used to write with that would basically take over the entire screen, and I had to do a very complicated button combination to have it not maximized, where I wouldn't hear any notifications, I wouldn't hear little dings from email, I'd put my phone on silent, and I would just write for however long I was going to write. Because when you talk about modern society and the potential for interruption throughout the day, it's in the hundreds, if not thousands. And it's amazing what happens when you do shut it all off and how scared you are. I left the house without my phone yesterday when I went to pick up my son. I think it was just because I'm blaming it because my paternal instincts kicked in and I was concerned about the boy. That's why I was like, forget the phone in some sort of recess of my brain. But man, I went to play some music when I was about halfway there. Couldn't do it.
Yeah, not good.
But yeah, okay. Well, if you're getting on a Thunderbird wagon, I might give it a try too. We'll see. I'll dip my toe in. We'll regroup 30 days. I'll let you know if I can survive without webmail.
Gotcha.
We'll see.
I rarely have the mental capability of checking anything while we're doing the show, but I will say Rent-A-Cal for now, like 3 weeks, I believe, has been in the YouTube comments. If I try Ubuntu or Mint from a live USB without installing to the hard drive, will I be able to determine if my laptop's Wi-Fi and other drivers work properly so I can decide if I want to install it? The quick answer is yes. If it works in the live environment, it will work when you install it. The long answer is yes, it will work, but it might require work. And I don't know why that is. I've seen more than a couple times in a live environment, Wi-Fi work flawlessly. Then you install it, Wi-Fi doesn't work. And then you got to research, look, and then you can get it to work.
Yep. But
most of the time, I'll say a good 90%+ of the time, it just works. The only issue I've seen lately in the last 2 or 3 years with the last 4 or 5 years worth of hardware is suspend might not work.
Suspend, resume. Yeah.
But every other piece of hardware I've had very little issues with. If you have a Broadcom wireless chip, that's the only thing I know that might be an issue. I haven't had any issue with any other wireless chip, especially when it's Intel Wi-Fi. I've had no issues. Odds are you're going to have no issues, I will say, if it works in the live environment. If you do have issues after install and it's your only computer, you should only dual boot when you only have one computer. You should never just completely wipe and install. You always should have dual boot because you always got to have something that's able to connect to the internet to find out issues. And if you do have issues, don't hesitate to shoot us an email. And I will say you do have a good name, Rent-A-Cal.
I'm going to argue with you a little bit. I would say that nowadays, with most people having smartphones as an internet-capable device, installed on the bare metal and go with it. You're going to be able to Google from your phone. You're going to be able to research through Yahoo on Bing if that's your deal. I'm not judging. This isn't court. But don't be afraid to do it. I mentioned this before, and some people will say, Cody, you're crazy. That's way too much work to go through to try this out. Okay, forget all that. If you're a geek like one of us, chances are you have maybe an older dead computer or an old dead laptop, or you know someone that does. Go up to that person and just be like, hey, I'm researching computer repair. Do you have any old computers that you're looking to get rid of that you'd just like to donate to me? When I'm done with it, I'll donate the parts to my local recycle center. Sure. You're going to hit somebody that you know, more than likely. I mean, even if it's a really, really old laptop. The point of that is you're going to be able to secure an old hard drive, whether it's a 10, 20, 40, 80 gig or up. You take that hard drive, even if it's an older IDE hard drive, you can get a cheap, converter on podus.com/Amazon ding for that to be used on a modern computer. Do a bare metal install on a second hard drive that you have in your machine. This is dubbed the Cody Cooper method. If you're really, really that apprehensive about installing on bare metal, just acquire another hard drive however you can and throw that in there. You're going to have an extra power cable, whether it be through IDE or SATA, more than likely already dangling there in your box. And you just use the data cable from the existing drive, unplug it, put it into the new drive, do a bare metal install that way. That way, you know what? You don't like it. It was too complicated. Couldn't get it to work. Boom. Plug the old drive back in. You're no worse for wear. There's no reinstall involved. It's all still there.
Butter.
Like butter. Is there butter in chowder?
There better be butter in chowder.
There's got to be butter in chowder, right? There better be butter in chowder. That's the best statement I've heard all podcast. Dor, it has been a pleasure once again this week to talk to you. Will you please remind us where we can find you online?
You can look me up on Google+, Door-to-Door Geek, or you can just go to podness.com. Pretty sure we have it. See, this is how not sure I am. I think we have a contact link right off of the main page. I'm not sure what isn't done.
I know that the lounge isn't working.
There is a contact button, and now there is dedicated live buttons too. So if you go to podness.com, there's a drop down for live Android App Addicts, Computer Repair Podcast, Geeksters Live, and Linux for the rest of us. What I and Jeff plan on doing is posting ahead of time. So right now, if you go to Android App Addicts Live, for instance, and you click the play button, you will see a countdown telling you when the show will be coming up. With, of course, the embedded chat right there, ready to roll. If I had the mental capability, I'd be watching that chat, but I don't, so let's not go there. You can hit me off on Facebook, Twitter, anything but Pinterest and Instagram and Snapchat.
So check him out on Friendster and make sure to give him give his MySpace page also, some love. Don't judge him.
You can also find me on Second Life and Active Worlds too.
But if you really, really want to get to the nitty gritty, you really should go to the classic My Little Pony BBS that he runs off of that Banana Pro. He says it's an own cloud server. I know the real deal. You can't. Yeah. Talk about yeah, don't just, hate the hate.
You just have
don't
to tell net to ponies are bronies too.
That's right. I guess I could full on laugh. Oh, by the way, please send in an email. Please send me an email to CodyPods.com if you think I sound better. I did not go through vocal training. I simply plugged in some equipment that I've had sitting in my office for far too long. Door helped me get it all hooked up, and I think it sounds great. More importantly, I hope that it's been doing its actual job, which is filtering out all the awful noise that's been in my living room these many years. So hopefully that is working, and I can't wait to hear your comments on that. If it's still coming through, or if you think I need a little bit more tweaking, I might do it, but we'll see. Only one way to find out, you got to tell me. Very, very good. And if you want to hit me up online, Twitter at Cody Cooper, Cody Cooper on Google Plus, send me an email to Cody@podness.com. And also, please just send door and door emails to door@podness.com to let him know what you think of the new site. If you haven't checked it out yet, just go to podness.com. A lot of work, a lot of blood, sweat, tears, nervous, fever dreams, terror, and just overall dread has gone into making that site what it is now, which is vastly better than what it has been for many years, I will say. We're not done, and by we, I mean everybody working on it who isn't me, because I'm not doing anything, but we need feedback. Feedback is always a gift if it's interpreted the correct way, and we would love to hear your feedback. So send feedback to door@podness.com and let him know what you do like, or if you have any constructive criticism, we would like to hear it. Also, if you want to send in an email to the show, please email just podcast@thestrestofus.com. If you want to send in a voicemail, please call 707-6-PODNA. That is 707-676-3688. Try to keep it under 60 seconds if possible. If it goes a little bit over, no problem. If it's going on for far too long, maybe consider breaking it up to a couple voicemails. We'll play them back-to-back weeks. And I'll get into the rest of the links next show, but please keep supporting those who support you. We love all of your feedback. Please continue to dole it out to us. And we are definitely continuing to go strong through the rest of the year. So, in closing, please do not forget that Linux is not just for all of us. It is for the rest of us. Good night.
Music provided by Steve Cherubino at stevecherubino.com.